about a reefer 5 feet long. Mighty mint, but not too strong. You'll be high, but not for long. If you're a viper, I'm the queen of everything. I've got to be high before I can swing. Light a tea and let it be. If you're a viper, when your throat gets dry, you know you're high. Everything is dandy. Truck on down to the candy store. Bust your conk on peppermint candy. Then you know your body's thin. You don't care if you don't pay rent. Sky's high and so am I. If you're a viper.
Nearly a century after California became the first state in the Union to prohibit the use of cannabis, a voter initiative may legalize its use for adults. The initiative represents a sea change of attitude and demographics in the nation's most populous state. It's a legal balancing act that exists in tension with federal law. Some see it as a necessary move for human rights, while others see an opportunity for the state to tax the lucrative cannabis activities of potrepreneurs. In Humboldt and other rural counties economically dependent upon cannabis cultivation, the initiative brings an opportunity to begin open discussion of an industry long illegal, but increasingly changed by the legality of medical use. In this first installment of the Cannabis Chronicles, we'll look at the initiative and answer the broad questions of what's at stake and why. We'll attempt to put the statewide issues in a local perspective and look at the implications for Humboldt's major industry. Discussions of marijuana prohibition almost always begin with the costs. The costs can be calculated in several ways. I spoke to Dale Geringer, the director of California Normal.
You've got 800,000 arrests nationwide. There's been over 2 million arrests in California since marijuana prohibition was passed. It's never advantageous to create more needless crime. And the costs of having a criminal record, of course, are always adverse to employment and opportunities and everything else. So, I think that's the primary issue. It's people in prison and people in jail and people with criminal records for no good reason.
The law enforcement costs are difficult to quantify, but run into the millions in California alone.
Well, there's the cost to go out and arrest all these people and prosecute them and imprison them and then, get the helicopters and so forth. It's a few hundred million dollars a year are spent on that in California from what we can figure out. It's sort of hard to get good cost figures.
And then there's the cost of keeping the black market illegal.
Foregone revenues from legal business are probably even bigger because you're talking about a multi-billion dollar business with legal job opportunities and associated sales and payroll taxes, and there would be an excise tax probably on marijuana the way there is on liquor and cigarettes in addition. So I think the foregone economic benefits from legal cannabis industry are probably bigger than the economic cost of prohibition currently in California.
The Tax Cannabis 2010 initiative was written and primarily funded by Richard Lee, a medical cannabis activist and the founder and president of Oaksterdam University in Oakland. He believes his initiative will begin to address the issues of human rights and economics.
The two basic parts to Tax Cannabis 2010 are that, first of all, it allows adults 21 and over in California to possess and cultivate small amounts of cannabis for their own personal consumption. That allows them to possess 1 ounce and grow 25 square feet, that's 5 feet by 5 feet, and possess the harvest. The second part allows cities and counties in California to tax and regulate sales and commercial cultivation.
The initiative is also constructed to avoid, as much as possible, conflict with federal law.
The local control. This is a key part to the initiative. We did it this way for a number of reasons. First of all, because of federal law, we can't mandate that any city or county or any person break federal law. We can only allow them to break federal law, you know, by getting rid of the state laws against it.
The initiative is written so local governments will be able to regulate the sale and cultivation of cannabis, and the state of California can create statewide guidelines.
The second reason the local control is so important is because it will allow cities and counties to tax and regulate the sales and commercial cultivation how they want to. Initially, it'll be cities and counties right after it passes, but we do have a clause in the initiative that allows the legislature to expand upon our initiative to come up with a more uniform statewide regulation, to implement statewide agriculture laws and things like that that apply for other crops. So we do see this as a first step. We do need to change federal law ultimately, but we believe that it's somewhat of a chicken and egg kind of thing, that we have to start somewhere, and until voters in states start to strongly show that they want to end prohibition by voting against it, federal law won't change. So we have to start here, and then eventually federal law will change once enough states vote to legalize it.
The initiative cannot, however, undo the convictions of those in prison for nonviolent offenses. Those imprisoned will have to begin a new legal process, something not readily available to the poor or poorly connected. Richard Lee.
They won't be released directly from any language in the initiative, but there is a legal precedent for releasing prisoners once a law has changed. Something that they were in prison for is no longer illegal. There is a way through the court system to petition for their release.
According to Richard Lee, the initiative is unlikely to bring in big tobacco or other national corporations to take over and dominate cultivation.
Until federal prohibition ends, that's not going to happen. There's no big multinationals or big corporations that are going to do anything while it's still illegal federally. And I see that as a few years off. But once it is legal, we will have to compete. But with the wine industry, you don't see just mass-produced wine. You see boutique wines, and, you know, the higher quality is done by small vineyards. And so I think a similar model will apply for cannabis once it's legalized.
One possible approach to uniform regulation the state may take is the passage of AB 2254, Assemblymember Tom Amiano's bill to legalize and tax cannabis. This bill, introduced in 2009, has already passed the Public Safety Committee, but is now being held from further action pending the results of the November election. Dale Gehringer describes the bill and what it might do.
It is a legalization bill that goes farther than the initiative does, because it establishes a statewide system of legal distribution of cannabis, and it puts no limit on the amount that people can possess. It would just be like alcohol. There's no limit on the amount of alcohol or cigarettes you can have. It's legal. You can have it. And that's the way the Amiano bill works, and it would have a state regulatory system managed by probably the Alcoholic Beverages Commission, or a souped-up version of that, that would have licensed outlets and licensed producers everywhere in the state, not just by local option. I think there would be a rush to have uniform state regulations if the initiative passed. I think concern about the irregularity of enforcement around the state might very well bring the legislature around very quickly to come up with something more uniform, the way the Amiano bill would be compatible, and as I say, the initiative allows that.
Sales of cannabis legalized by the initiative would be subject to tax, something the bill's proponents hope will encourage voters to say yes at a time when the state is desperate for income. The tax upon the sale of medical cannabis in dispensaries across the state is already worth a fair sum. Anita Gore is the spokesperson for the State Board of Equalization.
Our estimates are that between $50 and $100 million annually is sent to the Board of Equalization in the form of sales tax based on medical marijuana dispensary sales. The reason we can't be more precise is because we don't have a firm handle on how many dispensaries are out there. They do not have to tell us what they're selling or that they are a dispensary. They can put themselves in a category of, say, general merchandise sales or pharmaceutical sales or health food sales or something like that. So they don't have to tell us what they sell, and they self-report their category. So we don't have a good way of tracking how many sales are being made from medical marijuana dispensaries specifically, but our estimates are that we currently bring in around $50 to $100 million in sales tax.
An excise tax is the prize many observers see the state pursuing. If a $50 tax were indeed to be added to each of the estimated 16 million ounces of pot smoked in California yearly, the excise tax would be worth $800 million to the state, added to the $1.4 billion in sales taxes.
An excise tax, let me give you an example of, say, in cigarettes or alcohol. An excise tax, the cigarette distributor pays the excise tax. 87 cents a pack comes to the state of California at the time it goes to the distributor. Then the distributor can add that excise tax to the price of a pack of cigarettes, pass that along to the retailer, and then the retailer is required by law to charge sales tax on the total sales price of the pack of cigarettes. So there is part of a income stream from excise taxes and then sales tax on top of that. The excise tax on cigarettes goes for several different purposes. It's broken out, and it goes to the breast cancer fund. A portion of it goes to the general fund, and then there are other special funds that the excise tax on cigarettes goes to, and that's for health education and physician services, and then there's an early childhood development piece. So the excise taxes goes for those specific purposes, where the sales tax is broken out, part of it going to the state and part of it going to local governments.
Ammiano's bill earmarks the excise tax for the treatment of drug abuse and not to the state's general funds. Income from legalization would be no solution to California's economic woes.
Our estimates on the legalization of marijuana are that a total of about $1.4 billion in sales tax could be achieved. The current budget deficit is over $19 billion. So would it solve all our problems? I don't think anybody would make that reach. Would it make a contribution? Perhaps.
Another question is, what happens to medical cannabis should the initiative pass? Richard Lee describes the initiative's intent.
The initiative does not change Prop 250 or SB 420 or any of the medical marijuana laws or rights that medical marijuana patients have in California.
Dr. Frank Lucido is a general practitioner and a medical cannabis activist in Berkeley. He foresees dual tracks of regulation, one for medical and one for general use.
Well, I think both will exist. I think if either the Ammiano bill or the Tax and Regulate 2010, I think if either of them pass, then you're going to have parallel tracks. And medical will still be more protected, and the non-medical will at least be less attacked by law enforcement, perhaps, at least locally, and probably more welcomed by local governments that find that there's uncollected taxes that they can now collect. I don't think it'll necessarily mean more people using cannabis. I think anybody that wants to use it recreationally has already been able to use that, but it's the actual patients that have had trouble finding cannabis once they, you know, are sick and haven't been users, but now find that they want to try it. They're the ones that really have been benefited by medical, and that'll continue to be the case.
Dr. Lucido sees legalization as strengthening the position of medical cannabis.
Once you can tax and regulate and people can not have the fear of the law on them for small amounts, I think you're going to separate out medical from non-medical, in that patients that are not medical are not going to have to try to get the cover of their medical recommendation. I mean, I already do that in my practice by requiring corroborating evidence that their illness is serious enough they're going to see their doctor. But some of the quick in, quick out chains basically are seeing everybody that's 18 and over that says that it's helpful, and I think the statistics they gather from that are really not very useful. My job is to hold the center between the drug war people that don't want anybody to have it and drug reformers, some of whom I really respect and love, who feel that everybody should hide behind medical. Responsible marijuana users should not have to hide behind medical. It should be legal for their own purposes. I think there's a hierarchy that medical should come first, and then, of course, responsible use should not be illegal.
In addition to taxing and regulating sales, what might the future of legal cannabis bring to California? Dale Geringer, California Normal.
If the initiative passes, you're going to see a legalization on a localized basis, because the initiative really leaves it up to local counties and cities to determine how they're going to deal with it. And if experience with Prop 215 is any indication, there's going to be a lot of diversity, and most of the state will probably have nothing to do with legalized marijuana. But a few areas, like probably no doubt Oakland, where I'm from, and San Francisco, and a few other places, will probably establish themselves as centers of adult use cannabis, little mini Amsterdams. And I think it'll become a tourist issue, frankly. Like we're going to see cannabis tourism develop from that. And I wouldn't be surprised to see the North Coast, the Emerald Triangle, take advantage of that. So I think some parts of the state are going to jump ahead under the initiative and sort of take a leadership role, and it'll take a while for the rest of the state to come on. But that's assuming the initiative passes, and I think that's going to be tough to pass this initiative.
And what if California doesn't pass this initiative? What might that mean for future cannabis legalization efforts in the state and nationwide?
Well, it depends on the margin, doesn't it? If it's close, you know, I think it's going to advance things the way, and when I say close, I mean, you know, 45% or something like that. If it only gets like 35%, I think that there could be a real backlash by lawmakers. I know that Sacramento is fairly eager to try to get out there and tax and regulate the medical marijuana market that's there. And there's bills in the legislature to do that. And I think we will see a push for restrictions and regulations in the medical marijuana market. And the worse the initiative does, the more restrictive the likely bills that will be proposed.
Oakland, more than any other community in California, has made medical cannabis into a thriving local industry. Oaksterdam University gives classes on how to make the most of the business opportunities offered by Proposition 13, as well as on medical cannabis. Harborside Health Center is the largest medical dispensary in the state and has recently opened a second dispensary in San Jose. The city of Oakland is making considerable revenue from the college and the four dispensaries. Oakland's representative for cannabis did not return phone calls and emails requesting interviews for this show. Measure F, Oakland's cannabis business tax law, was approved overwhelmingly by voters last summer. It created a specific category and levies a tax of $18 per $1,000 of sales and gross receipts for all cannabis businesses in the city. Both Harborside and Oaksterdam were advocates for Measure F. Steve D'Angelo, the founder of Harborside, said Harborside alone expects to pay $350,000 in cannabis tax in 2010. Oakland is likely to earn between $750,000 to $1 million from cannabis taxes this year, and possibly even more. An economic study released last month said that AgriMed, a proposed indoor grow factory and a massive 7-acre warehouse in Oakland, could net the city of Oakland $2 million in yearly tax revenue on the projected production of 58 pounds a day. AgriMed, it should be noted, is the project of Jeff Wilcox, a member of the steering committee of Tax and Regulate Cannabis 2010. Oakland is already home to iGrow, the so-called Walmart of weed, a 15,000-square-foot big box selling all the necessary equipment for indoor hydroponic cultivation. From big box store to big box bud is only a small step in this brave new world, and the medical industrialists, or the dispensary cartels as some call them, are taking it. And what does any of this mean to Humboldt and other rural cannabis-growing counties? First, do not doubt that legalization and regulation are coming. Tom Amiano will resume attempts to pass SB 2254 in November. If Tax Cannabis 2010 fails at the ballot, another initiative will no doubt be prepared for 2012. Several things are a given whether or not the initiative passes. The price of marijuana will continue to drop. The black market will increasingly lose share. A black market is about big money only in the absence of a legal market, which is one reason why Humboldt weed prices have fallen as urban dispensaries thrive. When legal alternatives are available, the black market becomes a source of cheaper goods. A case in point is cigarettes. In New York City, a pack costs $9, including $1 in federal and more than $4 in city excise taxes. A thriving black market for cigarettes smuggled in from Indian reservations and out of state keeps the New York City revenuers jumping. A black market for cigarettes is about avoiding the tax for a lesser price. Should an excise tax of $50 an ounce land on marijuana, we may anticipate a similar phenomenon in California. In addition, the out-of-state market is shrinking and will continue to decline. There are now 13 other states with the increased supply and acceptance of medical cannabis laws. And it's come to the attention of the rest of the country that, well, the stuff does grow indoors. For Humboldt to regain some of the economic losses, its growers need to accept the realities of the wildly changing industry and economy. The issues of local control and state regulation are key and need to be addressed before legalization. Humboldt will be affected, and indeed could gain some footing, if the state begins to draft regulation that favors small rural growing and keeps it out of urban factories. This is going to be an uphill battle. Lucrative taxes entice city officials, and warehouse weed is already a jobs provider. Unions are rushing to organize growers and dispensary workers. But overlooked in the urban green rush is the issue of sustainability. Local blogger and journalist Kim Kemp notes that the 5,000-light AgriMed warehouse will use at minimum 60 million watts, or 6 megawatts of power a day. A megawatt powers about 500 California homes per year. One day of electricity use by this factory farm could power at least 3,000 homes for a year. And that figure does not include fans, filters, dehumidifiers, etc. Ruthlessly efficient, but not sustainable. Compare this to Colorado. A new law in Boulder requires medical dispensaries that grow their own product to offset 100% of the electricity they use to grow their plants with renewable energy projects. Humboldt's issues are now on the state and national radar, and Humboldt doesn't come off looking very together. Exposés about pot pollution of diesel and the water diversions and chemical fertilizer pollution of outdoor are regularly making state and national news. Part of regulation is likely to address these environmental concerns. If Humboldt's cannabis community wants to survive, it will have to begin accepting the idea of regulation by helping to draft sensible water, zoning, and environmental policy in collaboration with county government. Approaching the state now with clear definitions of sustainable cultivation practices to be incorporated into state regulation of legalized cannabis could help defend rural agricultural production. Arguments favoring small rural producers are supported by a recent study published in the International Journal of Drug Policy, which finds that small-scale domestic cultivation, generally called mom-and-pop here in Humboldt, is the most effective means of removing crime from the marijuana trade. Of course, the meaning of crime will shift with increased legalization, but other ills, pollution, excessive energy use, fire danger, are reduced when cultivation is done under license to small-scale growers who are also landowners, who in general attempt to avoid the possibility of polluting or destroying their own homesteads and property. The twin issues of local control and state regulation are crucial to the future of Humboldt and other cannabis counties. They are also, at this point, the most nebulous issues. Other counties are writing regulations and ordinances to govern the cultivation and sale of medical cannabis, mostly concentrating on zoning to avoid siting dispensaries close to schools and to abate nuisance complaints from neighbors, such as traffic, the risks of burglary, smells. The city of Arcata passed a land use ordinance regulating indoor marijuana cultivation, and Eureka passed a similar ordinance governing cannabis on June 1st. Mendocino County recently passed a cultivation ordinance, which uses nuisance abatement rather than zoning as the basis for regulation. The Mendocino Medical Marijuana Advisory Board objects to the ordinance for defining a medically necessary right as a nuisance and for being inconsistent with Senate Bill 420. Well-written ordinances governing the cultivation of medical cannabis in rural areas might not be a bad thing. Plans that establish a safe and rational use of water in sensitive salmon-bearing watersheds and that avoid pollutions of creeks and groundwater from fertilizers would benefit watershed residents and their environment. Fire and spill dangers from indoor grows could be minimized. The question is, who will write these ordinances, and more critically, who will enforce them? It's the citizens' job to be involved in their democracy. The newly formed Humboldt Medical Marijuana Advisory Panel is organizing around these issues and welcomes members and energy. For information, go to www.humap.org. Next week, the Cannabis Chronicles will look at medical cannabis, from the perceived superiority of indoor cultivation and the notion of pharmaceutical-grade cannabis, to the perceived dangers of the medicalization of marijuana, and what the future of outdoor is in the medical industry. The Cannabis Chronicles was produced off-grid with hydroelectric and solar power, using Skype and a laptop, and advised by the good offices of KMUD, Redwood Community Radio. Thanks to Marianne Norzer, Dave Smith, and Bob Froelich for technical support and advice. Opening music was Stuff Smith and the Onyx Club Boys, When You a Viper, written by Fats Waller, 1936. We're leaving you now with Ella Fitzgerald, When I Get Low, I Get High, with Chick Webb and his orchestra. I'm Liz Davidson. Thanks for listening, and talk to you next week. Oh, I get high.